Doris Dancy became a witness in a federal fair lending lawsuit based on what she saw as a credit manager for Wells Fargo in Memphis during the boom. My job was to find as many potential borrowers for Wells Fargo as possible. We were put under a lot of pressure to call these individuals repeatedly and encourage them to come into the office to apply for a loan. Most, 80% or more, of the leads on the list I was given were African American. The leads came from lists of Wells Fargo customers who had credit cards, car loans, or home equity loans with the company. We were supposed to try and refinance these individuals into new, expensive subprime loans with high interest rates and lots of fees and costs, Dancy explained. The way we were told to sell these loans was to explain that we were eliminating the customers' old debts by consolidating their existing debts into one new one. This was not really true. We were not getting rid of the customers' existing debts. We were actually just giving them a new, more expensive loan that put their house at risk. Our district manager pressured the credit managers in my office to convince our leads to apply for a loan, even if we knew that they couldn't afford the loan or did not qualify for the loan. I know that Wells Fargo violated its own underwriting guidelines in order to make loans to these customers. Many of the mostly African American customers who came into the offices were not experienced in applying for loans. Our district manager told us to conceal the details of the loan. He thought that these customers could be talked into anything. The way he pressured us to do all of these unethical things was as aggressive as a wolf. There was no compassion for these individuals who came to us trusting our advice. Mario Taylor, another Wells Fargo credit manager in Memphis, explained how the bank applied pressure to its almost entirely African-American prospects. We were instructed to make as many as 35 calls an hour and to call the same borrower multiple times each day, he said. Some branch managers told us how to mislead borrowers. For example, we were told to make teaser rate loans without informing the borrower that the loan was adjustable. Some managers changed pay stubs and used whiteout on documents to alter the borrower's income so it would look like the customer qualified for the loan. Borrowers were not told about prepayment penalties or about astronomical fees that were added to the loan and that Wells Fargo profited from. A common misperception then and now is that subprime loans were being sought out by financially irresponsible borrowers with bad credit. So the lenders were simply appropriately pricing the loans higher to offset the risk of default. And in fact, subprime loans were more likely to end up in default. If a Black homeowner finally answered Mario Taylor's dozenth call and ended it possessing a mortgage that would turn out to be twice as expensive as the prime one he started with, is it any wonder that it would quickly become unaffordable? This is where the age-old stereotypes equating Black people with risk, an association explicitly drawn in red ink around America's Black neighborhoods for most of the 20th century, obscured the plain and simple truth. What was risky wasn't the borrower. It was the loan. Camille Thomas, a loan processor, testified that many of these customers could have qualified for less expensive or prime loans, but because Wells Fargo Financial only made subprime loans, managers had a financial incentive to put borrowers into subprime loans with high interest rates and fees, even when they qualified for better price loans. The bank's incentives to cheat its customers were rich. Elizabeth Jacobson, a loan officer from 1998 to 2007, explained the incentive system. My pay was based on commissions and fees I got from making subprime loans. In 2004, I grossed more than $700,000 in sales commissions, nearly $1 million in 2020 dollars. The commission and referral system at Wells Fargo was set up in a way that made it more profitable for a loan officer to refer a prime customer for a subprime loan than make the prime loan directly to the customer. Underwriters also made more money from a subprime than a prime loan. Looking at these numbers, one could be tempted to minimize the role of racism and chalk it up to greed instead. I'm sure that most of the people involved in the industry would claim not to have a racist bone in their body. In fact, I heard those exact words from representatives of lending companies in the aftermath of the crash. But history might counter. What is racism without greed? It operates on multiple levels. Individual racism, whether conscious or unconscious, gives greedy people the moral permission to exploit others in ways they never would with people with whom they empathized. Institutional racism, of the kind that kept the management ranks of lenders and regulators mostly white, furthered this social distance. And then structural racism both made it easy to prey on people of color due to segregation and eliminated the accountability when disparate impacts went unheeded. Lenders, brokers, and investors targeted people of color because they thought they could get away with it. Because of racism, they could. Loan officer Tony Paschall was one of the few African-American employees in his section at Wells Fargo in Virginia. Wells Fargo's managers were almost entirely white, and there was little to no opportunity for advancement for minorities, he testified. Wells Fargo also discriminated against minority loan applicants by advising them that the interest rate on their loan was locked, when in fact, Wells Fargo had the ability to lower the interest rate for the applicant if the market rates dropped prior to the loan closing. And, he said, the bank often made this adjustment for white applicants. I also heard employees of the Mortgage Resource Division on several occasions mimic and make fun of their minority customers by using racial slurs. They referred to subprime loans made in minority communities as ghetto loans and minority customers as mud people. In addition, he said, his branch manager used the N-word in the office, not in 1955, but in 2005. Testimonies of Wells Fargo's corruption abound, but that bank was far from alone in its exploitation of black and brown people through aggressive marketing of subprime mortgage loans. As one of many examples, Countrywide Financial Corporation agreed in 2011 to pay $335 million to settle claims that it overcharged more than 200,000 black and Latinx borrowers for their loans, and steered some 10,000 borrowers of color into risky subprime loans instead of the safer and cheaper conventional loans for which they qualified. According to an analysis conducted by the U.S. Department of Justice, of 2.5 million mortgage loans made from 2004 to 2008 by Countrywide, black customers were at least twice as likely as similarly qualified whites to be steered into subprime loans. In some markets, they were 8 times more likely to get a subprime loan than white borrowers with similar financial histories. So much profit and so little accountability. The country's most ubiquitous bank, Bank of America, bought the infamous Countrywide in June 2008. Ameriquest, Bancorp South, Citigroup, Washington Mutual, and many other banks and financial companies contributed to a wave of foreclosures that shrank the wealth of the median African-American family by more than half between 2005 and 2009, and of the median Latino family by more than 2/3. There was a time, years in fact, when the epidemic of home foreclosures could have been stopped. Bank regulators and federal policymakers were well aware of what was happening in communities of color. But despite pleas from local officials and community groups, they did nothing to stop the new lenders and their new tactics that left so many families without a home. Between 1992 and 2008, state officials took more than 9,000 legal, regulatory, and policy actions to try to stop the predatory mortgage lenders that were devastating their communities and their tax bases. But Washington wouldn't listen. The Federal Reserve, the one entity with the authority to regulate risky lending practices by all mortgage lenders, took no action at all. And the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the regulator in charge of national bank practices, took one action, preemption, to make sure that no state's consumer protections applied to its national banks. In the virtually all-white realm of federal bank regulators and legislators, there was a blindness in those early years. Lisa Donner is a slight woman whose speech is peppered with almost involuntary little laughs, which I decided after years of working in the consumer protection trenches with her was a defense mechanism, a release valve for the pressure of having seen all the injustice she's seen. She got her start organizing working-class New Yorkers of color around affordable housing and foreclosure prevention with the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN, 30 years ago. She's now the executive director of Americans for Financial Reform, the David founded in the wake of the crash to take on Wall Street's lobbying Goliath and create a new regulatory structure to prevent a crash from happening again. Lisa has sat across the table from more financial regulators and bankers than probably anyone else in the country. I got in touch with her to reminisce about what it was like in the early days of the subprime phenomenon, when families like the Tomlins were being targeted by the block. The regulators were just refusing to see that there was a problem at all, Lisa said with one of her little laughs, because it wasn't their neighbors or their neighborhood or people who looked like them or people they knew in the elite decision-making circles. I have many such memories, but I'll never forget a meeting with a young, blonde Senate Banking Committee staffer in 2003. After hearing our research presentation, she said with a sad little shake of her head, "The problem was we put these people into houses when we shouldn't have." I marveled at the inversion of agency in her phrasing. Who was the we? Not the hardworking strivers who had finally gotten their fingers around the American dream despite every barrier and obstacle. No, the we was well-intentioned people in government, undoubtedly white in her mental map. Never mind that most of the predatory loans we were talking about weren't intended to help people purchase homes, but rather were draining equity from existing homeowners. From 1998 to 2006, the majority of subprime mortgages created were for refinancing, and less than 10% were for first-time homebuyers. It was still a typical refrain, redolent of long-standing stereotypes about people of color being unable to handle money, a tidy justification for denying them ways to obtain it. Lisa Donner understood the work that race was doing in shifting the blame for irresponsible lending and deception on to the borrower. Race was part of weaponizing the "it's the borrower's fault" language, she said to me. Conservative pundit Ann Coulter asserted it clearly in capital letters in the headline of one of her nationally syndicated columns. "They gave your mortgage to a less qualified minority." Another conservative columnist, Jeff Jacoby, wrote, "What does it mean when Boston banks start making many more loans to minorities? Most likely that they are knowingly approving risky loans in order to get the feds and the activists off their backs." By 2008, Jacoby was declaring the financial crisis a no-win situation entirely of the government's making. When asked during the market panic on September 17th about the root causes of the crisis, billionaire and then New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg told a Georgetown University audience that the end of redlining was to blame. "It probably all started back when there was a lot of pressure on banks to make loans to everyone. Redlining, if you remember, was the term where banks took whole neighborhoods and said, 'People in these neighborhoods are poor, they're not going to be able to pay off their mortgages. Tell your salesmen don't go into those areas,'" Bloomberg said. And then Congress got involved, local elected officials as well, and said, "Oh, that's not fair, these people should be able to get credit." And once you started pushing in that direction, banks started making more and more loans where the credit of the person buying the house wasn't as good as you would like. A man who'd made his fortune in financial information did not know that the mortgages at the root of the crisis were usually refinances, not home purchases, and that credit worthiness was often beside the point. But he knew enough of the elite conventional wisdom to blame the victims of redlining. The public conversation and the media coverage of the subprime mortgage crisis started out racialized and stayed that way. We've had so much practice justifying racial inequality with well-worn stereotypes that the narrative about this entirely new kind of financial havoc immediately slipped into that groove. Even when the extent of the industry's recklessness and lack of government oversight was clear, the racialized story was there, offering to turn the predators themselves into victims. After the crash, conservatives were quick to blame the meltdown on people of color and on the government for being too solicitous of them. Ronald Utt of the Heritage Foundation claimed that some portion of the problem, perhaps a significant portion, may stem from predatory borrowing, defined as a transaction in which the borrower convinces the lender to lend too much. With this banker-as-victim tale, the casting was familiar. Undeserving and criminal people of color, aided and abetted by an untrustworthy government. A conservative member of the U.S. Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the FCIC, Peter Wallison, wrote a vitriolic dissent of the commission's conclusion that the crisis was the result of insufficient regulation of the financial system. Calling that conclusion a fallacious idea, he claimed that the crisis was caused by the government's housing policies, specifically a set of policies called affordable housing goals. Banks, he said, became the scapegoat. And so many pundits blamed the Community Reinvestment Act for the financial crisis that the FCIC had to devote pages of its report to refuting the CRA's role conclusively. Jim Rakakis was the treasurer of Cuyahoga County, Ohio, from 1997 to 2011 and saw all the devastation. In 2006, he went to his U.S. attorney's office having amassed boxes of evidence he hoped would lead to a RICO conspiracy case about widespread mortgage industry fraud in the mostly Black and immigrant neighborhoods in and around Cleveland. In a room of men in suits from the FBI and other government agencies, Rakakis was sure that his impressive display of charts and graphs, foreclosure data maps, and transcripts was spelling out a slam dunk case for prosecuting a man named Roland Arnall. Arnall was one of President George W. Bush's top donors, whom Bush had nominated as ambassador to the Netherlands in 2006, and the CEO of the country's biggest subprime lender at the time, AmeriQuest, and its subsidiary, Argent Mortgage. But the racialized story was blinding to the government agents. They just couldn't see that the wealthy and well-connected white man was the criminal. At one point, one of the U.S. attorneys turned and said, "Well, who's the victim?" And I lost it. I said, "You're the victim. We're all the victims. Don't you get it? I'm here because Argent did this. I'm here because Roland Arnall and his minions have gutted Cleveland." Unable to see those with power as sufficiently blameworthy, the federal prosecutors declined to pursue Rakakis' case. He told me that county prosecutors did end up using his data to prosecute lower-level people. But it was too late. Had they gotten to this early and gotten to the foundation of this tree, Arnall and his executives, that tree would have withered and died. Lisa Donner saw how blame-shifting to borrowers of color was so effective after the crash that it stopped the Obama administration from mounting a full-throated campaign to save Black wealth. People who knew better let that language. It was the borrower's fault. They took out loans they couldn't afford. Control the politics of the response, she recalled. A whole bunch of Obama administration folks let that incredibly racialized story and their fear of the story, even if they didn't believe the story themselves, give us the recovery that we got, which was one that increased inequality and economic vulnerability. The Obama administration staff wasn't wrong about the perils of white public opinion and its political implications. In a study conducted in President Obama's final year in office, researchers simply switching the race of a man posing in front of a home with a foreclosure sign from white to Black made Trump-supporting whites angrier about government mortgage assistance programs and more likely to blame individuals for their situation. But back in the early 2000s, when I was digging through the data and immersing myself in the stories of loss, at first I didn't understand how the lenders were getting away with it, mostly escaping unharmed while making loans that were designed to fail. Why was the system not self-correcting when the loans so quickly became unaffordable for people and ended up in foreclosure? Then I discovered that the secret was mortgage securitization. Lenders were selling mortgages to investment banks, who bundled them and sold shares in them to investors, creating mortgage-backed securities. Instead of mortgage originations being driven by how much cash from deposits banks had to lend, now the driver was the virtually limitless demand from Wall Street for new investments. Unscrupulous financial companies could sell predatory mortgages they knew would sink the homeowner, package up those mortgages and sell them to banks or Wall Street firms, which would then sell them to investors, who could then resell them to still other investors, each of the sellers collecting fees and interest and then passing on the risk to the next buyer. Wall Street brokers even came up with a lighthearted acronym to describe this kind of hot potato investment scheme. IBG-YBG, for I'll be gone, you'll be gone. If someone gets burned, it won't be us. Securitization cut the tie of mutual interest between the lender and the borrower. Before securitization, however reluctant lenders had been to offer mortgages to people of color, once the loan was made, both parties had a vested interest in making sure it was properly serviced and repaid. Now, that connection had been severed. The homeowner's loss could be the investor's gain. Such financial malfeasance was allowed to flourish because the people who were its first victims didn't matter nearly as much as the profits their pain generated. But the systems set up to exploit one part of our society rarely stay contained. Once the financial industry and regulators were able to let racist stereotypes and indifference justify massive profits from demonstrably unfair and risky practices, the brakes were off for good. The rest of the mortgage market, with its far more numerous white borrowers, was there for the taking. Having learned how profitable variable rates and payments could be by testing them out on borrowers of color in the 1990s, lenders created a new version for the broader market. These were adjustable rate mortgages called option ARMs. Jim Vitarello, formerly of the U.S. Government Accountability Office, described option ARMs as the rich man's subprime loans. A significant portion of these, he said, went to white middle-class people. The average FICO credit score of borrowers who got option ARM mortgages was 700, which made them eligible for prime loans. More than half of the $2.5 trillion in subprime loans made between 2000 and 2007 also went to borrowers who qualified for safer, cheaper prime loans. What made option ARMs so appealing to this clientele was the choice. Debbie Goldberg explained, "With an option ARM, you could pick what you wanted your monthly payment to be based on. Was it going to be enough to pay off your home mortgage? Or was it going to be only the interest? Or was it going to be not even the interest? In that case, you had a loan that was negatively amortizing. You were building up more and more debt because you weren't even paying the full interest on the loan that you had on your home." These whiter, higher wealth option ARM borrowers were coming in at the peak of a housing boom and could see only the upside. But borrowers could choose their payments for only so long, a couple of months to a couple of years, before the lender reset the term so that borrowers had to pay off the full amount of the loan during the remaining years of the mortgage. "And you'd have a huge increase in your monthly payment," Goldberg explained, "because you'd go from not even paying the full amount of interest that you owed to paying a higher principal balance plus all the interest. That gamble worked only if the housing prices kept climbing." By 2006, up to 80% of option ARM borrowers chose to make only the minimum monthly payments. Housing values began to stall and slide in some areas, and immediately, more than 20% of these borrowers owed more than their house was worth. The option ARMs were ticking time bombs now nestled alongside other kinds of trap-laden mortgages, buried in securities owned by pension funds and mutual funds across the globe. And it wasn't just homeowners who were dangerously leveraged. The Federal Reserve had loosened the requirements on the five biggest investment banks, so they had been investing in securities based on debt with borrowed money, 30 and 40 times what they could pay back. In late 2007, when interest rates rose and housing prices started falling, the mortgage market at the center of the economy began to crumble. Wall Street firms that had bet heavily on the IBG-YBG formula knew better than to trust the other investment houses that had done the same, and suddenly, the market froze. By the time the housing market reached bottom, housing prices would fall by over 30%, and all five of the major investment houses would either go bankrupt or be absorbed in a fire sale. With the banks and the houses went the jobs. In the recession that followed, people were losing their jobs or having their hours cut back, Goldberg recalled. In that situation, you had mortgages that were perfectly safe and that, in ordinary circumstances, should have been sustainable, but people just couldn't afford them anymore because they'd lost income. And they couldn't sell their home because home values were going down all across the country. It was a vicious circle. This third wave of the financial disaster crested in 2008 to 2009, the period generally designated as the Great Recession, but the devastation that wave created continues even now. The wave swept over Susan Parrish, a white woman living in Vancouver, Washington, and changed her life in ways she couldn't have imagined. In 2011, Susan was 51 years old, recently divorced, and living in the three-story house where she and her ex-husband had raised their three children. She worked as the communications manager of a nonprofit organization. My ex-husband was a teacher, so between us, we were making close to $100,000 a year, she said. We were both working full-time. We were doing okay. Then she got laid off from her job. The recession had already eaten away at her organization. Several staff members had been laid off in 2009 and a few more shortly before Susan was let go. I started looking for other work right away, Susan recalled. To tide her over, she applied for unemployment insurance. I had never filed for unemployment in my life. It was an all-new thing for me. I had to go in and sit in these classes with people from all walks of life. It was just sobering to see how many people were out of work at that time. The classes were about how to write a resume and conduct a job interview, things Susan had thought she was good at. But in the years since, that's proven to be untrue, she said. I haven't been able to secure a job that pays anywhere near what I made. Immediately after she got laid off, Susan realized she wouldn't have the money to make the next house payment. She knew she had to sell the house, and she also knew how difficult that would be, given that she and her ex-husband had tried to sell it both before and after their divorce. Thankfully, she said, I was able to sell it, but I only made $1,700, which was just enough to pay first month's rent and a deposit on a 600-square-foot, one-bedroom apartment in a not-great-part of town. It was all I could afford, and she couldn't afford it for long. I was unemployed for 3.5 months. Finally, I was hired as a news clerk, and it was about $20,000 less than I had been making. I took it because I didn't see any other prospects. 6 months later, she was promoted to the role of education reporter. It was good, but it was still not a living wage, and I couldn't afford to rent an apartment now because housing was so expensive. I moved 5 times in 5 years, Susan said. 3 times in 3 months. I spent 3 months living in a backyard shed / artist studio with no heat or running water or toilet or kitchen because I had to save money to get my car fixed. That was hard, but I was glad I had the chance to live cheap so I could afford to get my car fixed. Susan was by all measures middle class, a college degree, a white-collar journalism job, but the Great Recession had pushed her to the brink of homelessness. I've tried not to be bitter, she said. She could not find a place to live that she could afford. After I lived in that backyard shed, my retired minister and his wife offered me their mother-in-law suite at below market prices, she said. She lived there for 4 years, becoming part of their family. At almost 60, Susan had a life very different from the one she imagined before the recession. She lived with her partner in an RV, 323 square feet in size, on a ranch he owned. 10 years after the recession, she was still freelancing and looking for full-time work. Susan's story of cascading loss and downward mobility has been replicated millions of times across the American landscape, due to the financial industry's actions in the 2000s. While the country's GDP and employment numbers rebounded before the pandemic struck another blow, the damage at the household level has been permanent. Of families who lost their houses through dire events such as job loss or foreclosure, over 2/3 will probably never own a home again. Because of our globally interconnected economy, the Great Recession altered lives in every country in the world. And all of it was preventable. If only we had paid attention earlier to the financial fires burning through Black and brown communities across the nation. Instead, the predatory practices were allowed to continue until the disaster had engulfed white communities too, and only then, far too late, was it recognized as an emergency. There is no question that the financial crisis hurt people of color first and worst. And yet, the majority of the people it damaged were white. This is the dynamic we've seen over and over again throughout our country's history. From the drained public pools, to the shuttered public schools, to the overgrown yards of vacant homes. Being among the outmatched and unheeded few who tried to prevent the catastrophe that would become the Great Recession was an experience that would forever shape my understanding of the world. I saw how money can obscure even the most obvious of truths. I learned that in order to exploit others for your own gain, you have to first sever the tie between yourself and them in your mind. And racist stereotypes are an ever-ready tool for such a task. But when I watched the CNN ticker tape announce the fall of Lehman Brothers on September 15, 2008, I was struck by an even deeper truth. Ultimately, it's impossible to sever the tie completely. Wall Street had recruited the brightest technological minds, those who a generation ago would have been putting a man on the moon or inventing vaccines, to engineer a way to completely insulate wealthy people and institutions from the pain inflicted by their profits. Ultimately, they failed, and so did one of the oldest and most successful financial firms in U.S. history, setting off a financial contagion we still feel today. It wasn't until years later that my research would reveal just how literally the country's original economic sin was connected to the financial crisis of 2008. The first mortgages and collateralized debt instruments in the United States weren't on houses, but on enslaved people, including the debt instruments that led to the speculative bubble in the slave trade of the 1820s. And the biggest bankruptcy in American history in 2008 was the final chapter of a story that began in 1845 with the brothers Lehman, slave owners who opened a store to supply slave plantations near Montgomery, Alabama. The brothers were Confederate Army volunteers who grew their wealth profiteering during the Civil War, subverting the cotton blockade, buying cotton at a depressed price in the Confederacy and selling it overseas at a premium. They first appeared on what would become Wall Street by commodifying the slave crop, co-founding the New York Cotton Exchange. Although the company would later diversify its business beyond the exploited labor of African Americans, like so much of American wealth, Lehman Brothers would not have existed without it. 150 years later, a product created out of a synthesis of racism and greed yet again promised Lehman Brothers unprecedented profits and delivered for a short while. Heavy investments in securitized toxic loans brought it the highest returns in its history from 2005 to 2007. Even as defaults on mortgages began to skyrocket across the country, the company's leadership held on to the idea that it could endlessly gain from others' loss. Lehman's CFO asserted boldly on a March 2007 investor conference call that rising mortgage defaults wouldn't spread beyond the subprime customers, and the market believed him. So many wealthy, and yes, white, people assumed that the pain could be contained on one side of the imaginary human divide and transmuted into ever higher profits on their side. During the same summer that I stood in the middle of the street with a foreclosure map that exposed the devastation behind almost every Black-owned door, Lehman would go on to underwrite more mortgage-backed securities than any other firm in America. By the end of the next summer, the illusion had been broken. In a freefall that began on a weekend in mid-September, Lehman Brothers would go on to lose 93% of its stock value. A company born out of a system that treated Black people as property died from self-inflicted wounds in the course of destroying the property of Black people. Lehman's fate provides no justice for the enslaved people whose misery the company enabled in the 19th century, nor for the dispossessed homeowners ruined by Lehman-owned mortgages in the 21st century. But it is a reminder that a society can be run as a zero-sum game for only so long. Back on Creasy Avenue with the Tomlins, I felt like I was glimpsing not only an alternate past in which more borrowers had their just resolution, but maybe an alternate society in which more people had their values. I was asking Janice and Isaiah about the court case when the lawyer, Mal Maynard, jumped in. I gotta throw in my two cents here. Of course, Janice is one of my all-time heroes. One of the greatest days I've ever had in court was in Winston-Salem in the North Carolina Business Court, which is always a bad place for consumer cases. There was a judge who was really famous for being very, very hard on the class actions, especially when they were filed by consumers. After Janice took the stand, the skeptical judge asked her, basically, why she was there, why she was willing to swear an oath to represent the interests of over 1,000 people she didn't know. Janice continued in her own words, "I just remember telling the judge that every morning when I walked into my classroom before we started our day, I taught my second graders to place their hands on their hearts and quietly say the Pledge of Allegiance. And I had taught them that when you give allegiance to something, you say that I honor this and I have faith in it. And I knew that if I taught that to my children, that I best be living by it myself." Maynard continued, "And from that moment forward, she transformed Judge Tennille. She really did. He believed in us, and he believed in our case from that point forward. There was still a lot of hard-fought litigation, but he knew, and Janice convinced him, that this was really legitimate, heartfelt work that was being done by her and by the lawyers in the case." A far-off look in Janice's eyes made me wonder what else had been guiding her that day. Finally, she said, "My daddy used to say, drop a little good in the hole before you go. That sticks with me. I was just trying to be a good citizen. And I was just letting that judge know that I had no other reason to come here. Because somebody's name had to be there. Did I want it to be our names? No, I did not." Maynard and the Tomlins' suit for deceptive, unfair, and excessive fees and breach of fiduciary duty to the borrower prevailed in 2000 with a settlement of about $10 million. So, borrowers all over North Carolina got checks thanks to Janice and Isaiah, Maynard said with pride. Janice allowed a small smile. "That's a lot of people being served, you know? It was more than worth our names being in the newspaper. We should have been so very embarrassed at the end of that, but I wasn't, because I felt like I had put a little good in the hole."